Okay, well then, I would like you to talk a little bit about the origination of the idea for Cooley Law School and how this entered into your activity while you were sitting on the court, and then it caused some frictions later on and all that sort of thing. Would you deal with that for a while?
Okay, of course, I'd been Chief Justice. I went off as Chief Justice at the end of 1970 and found myself with a good deal of time on my hands. I was accustomed to working a 16, 18-hour day as Chief Justice. And suddenly all I had to do was take care of my own opinions and do my own thing.
File dissents.
And file dissents. I had a lot of dissenting opinions to write, no question about that. But even there, a dissenting opinion is not nearly as much work as a majority opinion, because you don't have to do the original scholarship. You just sort of have to take a pot shot at what the other person does, and say why his arguments or her arguments don't make sense.
Sort of a counterpunch.
A counterpunch, which is easier. It's shorter. Generally, and there is not nearly as much discipline in the writing of dissents. Anyway, I set about to build a kitchen in my house, and for about 6 or 8 months, I was very much involved in that. Due course of time, I can't tell you when it was, but I used to get a lot of telephone calls from people who wanted me to help get their sons or brothers or cousins into law school. And they'd usually say, "Judge, I helped you in your election campaigns, and now it's time for you to do me a favor. Have you got any connections at the university?" And I would make phone calls on behalf of friends and supporters and say to the dean of the law school, "Can you do any good for this person?" or whatever. And typically the answer came back. I remember one time being told that there were 6,000 applications for 300 seats at the University of Michigan Law School. And so it was just a terrible crunch, and it wasn't a prayer getting anybody in. So one particular time I was calling a fellow back to tell him that I couldn't help him. As a matter of fact, he's a bondsman out of Detroit by the name of Chuck Goldfarb. And we were having this conversation, and I said, "I can't help you." I think it was his brother he wanted to get into law school. And he said, I said, "You know what I ought to do? I ought to start a law school up here in Lansing. We could use one."
Just spontaneously?
Just
like
all those off-the-cuff, joking, half-joking comments, you know. And he sort of laughed. He said, "Well, you know, you do that, Judge, and I'll send you your first $1,000.
And he did.
So we both laughed and hung up the phone. And I sat there thinking about it and thinking about the crush of applicants to the law school and so on, various law schools. And I called in my law clerk, then a young man by the name of John Gibbons, and I said, "John, what do I have to do to start a law school?" And he said, "I don't know." And I said, "Well, find out."
This is 1971.
This is 71. So he went and came back in about an hour, and he said, "Well, if I'm correct, Judge," he said, "I read the law. All you need to do is to form a nonprofit corporation." And I said, "What do I need for a nonprofit corporation?" And he replied that I needed 3 citizens, $20 filing. So I said, "Well, John, there's you and I, and I'll get a third fellow." I called my friend Lewis A. Smith, who was a local attorney, and I said, "Lou, I'd like to start a law school. Would you like to be on my board of directors?" And he said, "Sure." I said, "Okay."
What is the law clerk's name now?
John Gibbons.
Just like it sounds. Huh?
Yeah. And Lou Smith agreed. I then prepared proposed articles of incorporation, for a law school to be called the State College of Law, and gave it to John Gibbons to file over in the Corporation Securities Division. And John put up the $20 for the filing fee. The first thing that the lady did at the Corporation Securities Commission when she received the articles was, seeing that it was called for the creation of an educational institution, was to put the application for a charter in her drawer instead of routinely stamping it and issuing the charter, because she understood under the law that there were certain requirements that had to be met, and that the State Department of Education would have to pass on this thing. Well, then we heard from the Department of Education. I believe at that time John Porter was the Superintendent of Public Instruction. And the first thing they told us was that we couldn't use the name State College of Law, because it inferred that the state had some role to play in our college, and that the word state was a word of art in these things. The only time you could use the word state in the name of a school was if, in fact, it was a state university or state college. So that was fine. I had written a letter to Stanley Beattie,